So without further ado, I will introduce Matt.
Well, here we go. Thank you so much, Karen, and thank you to the committee for asking me to come this weekend. And it's been great. It really has. Thanks for my host, Jason, his wife. They've been great, really taking care of me, and I really enjoyed also listening to the other speakers this weekend. It's been great. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly do, and I can go anywhere in the world and find family. And that's not what I was looking for when I came here. My name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And my sobriety date is May 1st of 2008. So last Monday I celebrated 15 years. And Thank you. I have a home group, and I also have a sponsor, and I have the privilege of taking other guys through the steps as I have been taken through. And I'll tell you, both sides of sponsorship has really just lit me up and still gets me fueled today. I'm more convinced today than ever that I can't do this alone. And through the past couple years, when things shut down and everybody went in, I also went in, and I really missed this. Didn't realize how much I like this, because I'm more of an introverted person. I can be okay by myself, quite all right. But I had no idea how much I missed you guys and being in the flesh, in person, and the fellowship, how much it means to me. And I'm tickled to death to be here. It's truly an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And towards the end of my drinking, I was a taker of things and a user of people, and I didn't care. Even the closest people to me, I was pushing them away. And I was by myself, and I didn't have anybody to invite me over. As a matter of fact, people were trying to keep me away. And to have a welcome like I've had this weekend, it just means the world to me. It truly does. My upbringing was pretty great. You know, I can't point the finger at it as where I went astray and why I was reaching to alcohol for a solution. I grew up, we bounced around a lot and moved to a couple different states. We landed in North Carolina, and that's where I say I'm from, if you ask me where I'm from, just because it's the short answer. And the two great parents, you know, they'd do anything for us, you know, growing up. And there was that thing that I've heard shared to this weekend and from other people, that just wasn't right. Something inside, this internal dialogue that I had, like, well before I even can remember, really. Like, for example, my mom told me a few years back that I came up to her at 3 years old, dead serious as a three-year-old can be, and said that I know I'm adopted and I need to know where my real family is. And she tried to hold back laughter, I'm sure, as well at that time. And I just don't know where those thoughts come from. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic, but they were there. They were there. And I've done the research, and they are who they say they are. I truly, I couldn't have asked for or received better parents. You know, they did everything they could to provide for us. I have a younger sister as well, who I have a great relationship today, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. Wasn't always the case. But when we were younger, maybe six to eight years old range, my parents both were working. You know, they were doing what they could to provide for us, and we had babysitters. Jason was telling me yesterday that they had got some babysitters, and it reminded me of my babysitter experience. And I didn't like the babysitter. She is trying to assert her authority over my domain. So I lured her out of the house, ran back inside and locked the door. She had to go next door to the neighbors to call my parents to say, like, your son just locked me out of the house. I can't get in. And, you know, from a very young age, you know, this was years before my first drink. You know, lack of power was my dilemma. I really did not like other people telling me what to do. And I had an inability to surrender from as early as I can remember. And the thoughts that I had growing up were, you know, I had a lot of, you know, friends and was, you know, pretty on the outside was looking like a normal kid, but the internal dialogue was just wicked. And I had one night I remember, well, there were several, but I used to cry in bed because my dad traveled for work, and I just would come up with these stories like he's gonna not come home. He always came home. But I was like, you know, I would just forecast negativity. And so, you know, it was long overdue, and at age 12 when I was able to find a solution to all of those problems. And my buddy and I, my best friend, you know, we found his mom's stash of vodka, and the fact that we found it makes me think we were looking for it for some time. This was a summer going into sixth grade, and it changed the trajectory of my life. We ran off into the woods with little water bottles full of vodka and a splash of orange juice, and I opened those up and proceeded to have a spiritual awakening in the woods. It is a lower spirit, but it was still an awakening nonetheless. On first contact, I thought it was rubbing alcohol because the burning sensation was such that my throat started to close. But then a second later, that warm, you know, jello just was poured over top of me. And I finally found some peace and some quiet. And all of those voices, that internal dialogue, all of that fear, all of the anxiety that I was running around with for the last 12 years was gone. And I could just be me. And I would continue to try to get there. I would always try to get back to that place, I would say, for the rest of my drinking. Problem is, like, the consequences would catch up with me, and at least at age 12, my resources were limited, so I was only able to steal so much from her before we had to go and switch suppliers. But I'm, even as I look back as a kid, pretty clever and, you know, conniving. And like I said, I'm a taker of things and user of people. So I would find the people that I needed to exploit to get what I needed to get. We used to have this game called Hey Mister, and it was just like, Hey Mister, you know, that's exactly how it went. That's all you had to say. I think things have changed a little bit these days, but those were the activities that I looked forward to when my other friends were studying for the SATs and doing, like, you know, high school sports. I would be very competitive and talented in sports, but something changed where the effects produced by alcohol became paramount to anything else, to the effects produced by good grades, by perspective. So going to college to play sports, all of these things. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I do believe right around 16 or 17, I crossed over that invisible line where I lost the choice in drink. And now I'm not drinking for fun. I'm drinking to overcome an obsession that separates me from normal people. But, like, you know, I'm young. It's kind of cute when you get in trouble when you're young. And things didn't really start catching up with me until I got my driver's license. And I found out I liked to travel when I started to drink. It just happened like that. I did a lot of the things that all of us do when we drive, you know? And I felt that as long as we got there safely, it's all that matters. The close one eye thing, that worked for a while. But then it was scary. I'm not gonna lie, you know, when I was starting to wake up in places I don't remember going to sleep. And I was a blackout drinker. Before I knew what a blackout drinker was, I just thought that was a good time. And things started to happen. I started to like wake up and have to put the pieces of the puzzle together like a detective. You know, I'm like, okay, look at, you know, see if there's anything on the walls. Where, you know, where are my keys? Where are my clothes? Where am I? These types of things. Normal, I don't think normal drinkers, 17 years old, are having these types of mornings. But there wasn't anything that I did or that, you know, that somebody said I did that was so bad that another drink couldn't make it better. It was like I could just blot out whatever happened last night with more drinking. And it also helped the hangover. I still tell people that these days. They don't get it. You know, if they drank too much the night before, I'm like, yeah, just have another drink today. And they're like, what? Like, that doesn't make sense. And I'm like, oh, it makes perfect sense. But I'm 16 now. I'm in and out of school. I've moved to a different high school because I couldn't play well in the first one. And went to boarding school 1 year. Tried to come back to public school. That didn't work. And I'm starting to get in trouble. I went and got my first DUI. You know, it was also my first time drinking out in public at 17. I was able to get into a private club, knew some people, and already knew what I was going to order before I even went to the bar. Because I'm like that. I think about what I'm going to say before I say it and have things planned out. So Makers and Ginger was my first drink in public. And I went out and I had one and two, and then I was in the zone and went and talked to some girls, and they laughed, and I laughed with them. I didn't know if they were laughing at me or what, but it didn't matter. It was it. And later that night, I ended up seeing the blue lights in the back of the car for the first time, going to jail. And I did what I did when I get in trouble. I called home. It was around 3 a.m. My dad picks up the phone, and I'm like, "Hey, I'm in jail." He's like, "I'm sleeping. I'll think about it in the morning." Click. This wasn't the response I was looking for. But I left that night, or woke that next morning, that experience, and figured I just needed to find somebody else to drive me around. That was the problem. Got into some more trouble, and as a result of that, this was back in like 99, I think, that DUIs weren't as, I mean, they're serious, but they weren't as severe as they are today, and they sent me to a drug and alcohol assessment. And this, for those who haven't taken one of these, it's a standardized test for your partying lifestyle behavior. Well, I'm a smart guy, you know. I thought I knew, you know, how to tell people what they needed to hear so that I can do what I need to do. But I failed the test, and or passed it, depending on what side you're on. And the result of that was somebody told me that I needed to go to ANA. And I said, what's the ANA? I got a pamphlet of a meeting. It was in a church basement. And I'm just checking off the, you know, the boxes here. I got to do what you got to do to stay out of jail, stay out of trouble. 17 years old, going to a church basement in Raleigh, North Carolina, open the doors and get poof, hit with this cloud of smoke coming out. I didn't know if there was something on fire in there. There was so much smoke. It was one of the bars that I would later enjoy going to. But I just walk in kind of a little timidly. And sure enough, there's people in there. I can hear them. And as I walk down the hall, I can start to see them and make out their faces. And these people are old. I mean, I'm talking about like Tales from the Crypt, like old, old. Kept the alcoholics under the church. And I mean, I'm... All right. Well, I'm glad you guys are here. I'm glad that, you know, you're not driving and you've got yourself together. This is what an alcoholic looks like in my mind. These are alcoholics, and thank goodness you guys have found out AA. I personally was 17 years old and had it all figured out. So the only thing I heard, besides them being really nice, you know, and it was keep coming back. And I said, yes, I will. In about 50 years, you guys be good. I'm going to, you know, just go on my merry way. Remember, I just need to find somebody to drive me around now because I lost my license. That's the problem. Got into some more trouble and moved. I was given the ultimatum by the judge to move. I could either move or do some, you know, weekend in jail or community service or something. So I was always taking the easier, softer way. Thought a geographical change would help. But I found exactly what I was looking for when I moved to the mountains in North Carolina. Didn't move far enough, yeah. He's been. and I mean, instead of drinking whiskey, I'm drinking cognac because I'm more of a fluent alcoholic. You know, I'm making more money. And I found moonshine, and this is a much more efficient way to drink the real stuff. And it's just like I just substituted, you know, one landscape for another, and it was much, you know, it was nicer out in the mountains. I think it was pretty, but nothing changed, you know. And I've always heard if nothing changes, nothing changes, and it's just one of those stupid, poignantly true statements, slogans that like we hear. Like nothing changed. I brought me with me, and I found exactly what I was looking for. I still hadn't finished high school. But I went to work because, you know, who needs to go to high school anyway? It's like making money is what really matters. I wanted to go and make my, you know, build my empires. That's what I did. And I started working, was doing well, was able to travel like I wanted to. And in the winter times, we would snowboard, and in the spring and summer months, I would longboard, like long skateboard. Similar to like a snowboard on wheels. And this one night, I hadn't gone down this particular slope before, this one hill. I was going a little bit too fast towards the bottom, and I tried to power slide. And I don't remember what happened, but what I was told is I head to concrete, going about 10 miles an hour with no helmet. Thankfully, my roommate at the time saw it from a distance and was able to like run down and get the ambulance to come and scoop me up off the ground and bring me to the hospital. Now, I was living out, you know, on my own. My parents were close by, so they get the phone call early in the morning. They go to the hospital, and it wasn't looking good. I was posturing on the scenes. So it was pretty much, you know, showing signs of brain damage. And the neurosurgeon said, look, like, we're going to have to put him into a coma, and we're not going to know what's going to happen. The next 72 hours are just like, we're powerless. We're going to have to sit and wait. And my parents did what they do, and that's just, they prayed. They sat there at the hospital. And the neurosurgeon, a couple, you know, days later, the next day, came and said, you know, something happened that's not medically, you know, explainable. And the brain went from all the way to one side back to almost center. And we can't explain it medically, but it's a good thing. And it would still be several weeks, a couple months of recovery, having had to learn how to walk again and put shoes on, the right feet and cognitive, all of this, that therapy. I would just be on the road to recovery. And I think about 2 or 3 months after the accident, I get released from a rehab hospital. My buddy picks me up, passes me a flask and one of those medicinal cigarettes that's not quite legal in that state yet. And out just without a blink of an eye, I was right back on it. Now this time with some high powered painkillers that I needed legitimately, I would also find would allow me not to drink as much. One of the reasons I tell that story is, one, it's just, it's another miracle. That's what we're celebrating this weekend. And I also like to share it because to this day I haven't thought about getting on a skateboard. Now, I'm what the book would call a hard skateboarder. With sufficient consequences, I can stop. No problem. Alcohol wasn't like that. I'm like the jaywalker in the chapter more about alcoholism. You know, I just go back out into the street after getting hit one more time. Maybe this time's going to be different. Maybe it's not. I don't care. Like, I'm just going to go for it. Let's see. And at that was when I was 19. And from that point on till what I prayed to be my last drink at 23, it got really dark. It got really dark, and I started to do things that I'd say I'd never do, and I started to treat people like I say I never would treat them. All of those morals and the principles that I was taught growing up, like, I just kind of set those aside because I was in survival mode. I mean, I was ready. I had to do what I had to do to continue this fantasy life and this disease. It needed constant attention. It was no longer like, hey, let's go have fun on the weekends. This was like a full-time job. But at the time, it seemed like the only normal life. This was just my lot. Yet at any point in time, like, I could have, you know, thrown up a flag and said, hey, I need help. There were people in my life. I had great people in my life that were always willing there. I think a lot of us, you know, do have people around. But it's like I became so consumed with self that I couldn't see it. And even if I did see it, I just, you know, would rather, just like, you know, I'm only hurting myself. Let me just leave me alone. And at the last thing I had tried, really, I mean, I tried location changes. I tried changing my, you know, my drinks. I tried moving around the country, and nothing was really happening. My last ditch effort to try and control and enjoy my life was to get into a relationship. I didn't see it at the time. I didn't think of it as such, but I was hanging out with this group of people who were kind of like, we ran in Gotham City, like, we didn't really see the light of day too much. We were mostly night people, and this pretty young lady had joined our group. She just got out of prison, and so I felt like I could trust her. That's where I was, you know, living in the dark side. I mean, you gotta be careful, everybody, you know, there might be an informant. But I figured I could trust her since she just got out. And we started running together, and it was just like, it was it. I mean, it was great. We played hard, party hard, and would start showing up more and more places I couldn't get out of. Like, I don't know. My drinking oftentimes starts by what I thought was a conscious decision on myself. Little did I know I had lost the choice. But it'll start me, hey, we're at a Mexican restaurant. It's, you know, Coronas and tequila. That just makes the most sense. But then what happens is I get that physical allergy where I start drinking and I can't stop. I'll supplement it with other things, trying to continue on, you know, but ultimately, like, this is a train going downhill. And in my experience, in those last few years of my drinking, where I never consciously, voluntarily stopped. I didn't have the power. My hat's off to those who do. But for me, like, I always ended up in places I couldn't get out of. Like jails and institutions. Those were two of my favorites. I found out that if the law is looking for you, you can check yourself into a hospital and they can't tell them where you are. So I thought I was a smart alcoholic. I thought I was really managing well here. And then I would go, I'd check myself in, and I would come up with a plan. Plan, figure it out, get fed all types of whatever they, you know, Valiums and stuff. They'll get me to, like, just chill out for a moment, come up with a plan, and I'd get discharged and keep running. And I was a runner. Like, that's what I did. I ran. These behaviors and these decisions would eventually catch up with me, and the judge got tired of seeing me, and we me and Bonnie, we ran and did. I mean, you know, the story doesn't end well. You watch the movies, and it didn't end well in real life either. The thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you guys would like show up in those places I couldn't get out of a lot of the time. You know, they'd be like, "Hey, meeting," and I'm like, "What? They're here?" You know, like, what's wrong with these people? Why would they be coming here? And you would come, and it'd be like, you know, one of the nice old ladies from that first meeting I went to, and they would, you know, they'd just be really nice, and I would listen, and I'm, you know, okay, it's great. But you guys were watering the seed each time. Each time the seed was being watered, and I started to put the pieces of the puzzle together, and I realized that, you know, drinking is definitely a common denominator in a lot of these decisions, poor decisions that I'm making. But what's really interesting is that most of my poor decisions were in between drinks, in pursuit of. I've made some really poor decisions while drinking too, but if I look at it, like, I don't know how to manage sober. I don't know how to live life. I don't have the tools. I missed out on those tools. How to live between drinks. I didn't know that. I thought that drinking was the problem. But if drinking's the problem, then any one of those long-term facilities that I was at for 30 days or more, like, everything would be okay when I got out. But everything wasn't okay. So anyways, I get exposed around. I go around and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like a basketball in a hoop, and no points, no relief. I'm just as crazy sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous as I am out there and running around in the world, trying to kill myself slowly. And my last ditch effort to try and get sober, I was checked into a place, I came out, and I think I had around like 50-something days. I could never get 60 days. So that was a miracle. 30 days, I could be like locked in a cage somewhere and be okay. But then 60 was always outside of my reach. And around 54 days, I was at a Mexican restaurant and got thirsty and I would drink. And then from that point on, over a two-week period, we did some things that, you know, I assume there's no coming back from. And I was ready to die. Like, I really, truly, truth be told, like, if I knew that I was going to survive that month, I might not have done what I did. Now that's Matt's ego thing. But what's really beautiful about Alcoholics Anonymous and having had this transformation as a result of the steps is that I realize now that there's nothing that I can do so bad that God can't turn into an opportunity to help somebody else. Whereas in the past, like, I needed a drink to make me be okay with me. Now those mistakes can be used and are used regularly to help others. What a beautiful thing. So we ended up going on another spree of the criminal variety and drinking as well and running. And I knew my plan was to go home, say goodbye to my mom, grab a change of clothes, and get out of the state, get out of the country, and just taking all along the way until somebody, you know, was tired of taking and ended it for us. As I drove into that neighborhood, my parents lived in a gated community, so I had to punch in. Mom hadn't heard from me in a while. She opens the gate. I come driving in, and then there's some undercover waiting for me down in the down the street. I tried to tell him where I was, you know, play it off like I was just, you know, coming back home from the grocery store, but he didn't believe the story, and I ended up in the back of his car really quickly. Within a few minutes, I turned back and I see there's another dog in my car, and it's not mine. And I was, yeah, we were wanted, and considered armed and dangerous, even though we weren't. But they're getting, regardless of the legalities of everything, like, it was a big deal. And few more minutes pass, and here comes my mom, because, you know, I'd buzzed in 10, 15 minutes ago, and she hadn't heard, you know, where was I? And I see her talking to one of the agents, and then she drives by the car that I'm sitting in, and the look on her face, I can only describe as a mother that's standing over her son's casket. Fortunately, I've had to see that and being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a very sad thing. And to see that on my mom's face, something inside of me that I didn't know I had still, it broke. And I cried out to a God that I'm pretty sure didn't want anything to do with me based on my past behaviors. And I said, I can't live like this anymore. Please help. I don't know if it was out loud or if it was just one of those things that combusted from the inside out. It doesn't really matter. The first thing I thought of, almost instantaneously, were those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those kind people who continued to welcome me back time and time again. And it would be great if you know, they let me out on bail that day and I was able to go back to my home group and have been holding a commitment ever since. But that's not the way life works. And that's not the way Alcoholics Anonymous works either. You know, we have to make restitution for the harms done. So without knowing it, you know, in the back of that car, I took the first three steps, and then the judge would ultimately do a good job of providing my first four step for me. And then I'm sitting there before him talking to my lawyer about my fifth step. I had some serious time ahead of me. I was 23 years old. I'm facing 929 months in a federal penitentiary for a series of things that had happened over the past couple years, but specifically in the last two weeks. And it wasn't looking good for the home team. Needless to say, I'd run out of options. And when I look back at my journey from then till now, one of the greatest gifts and acts of grace that I received is the elimination of options. Like, I don't have a plan B. If this stops working, I don't have a plan B. Like, I didn't then, and I don't still today. And that's, I can't give that to somebody, but I've received it, and I'm so thankful for it. Because it is only when, you know, I'm able to reach out for this life draft of Alcoholics Anonymous that my ego can just be quiet enough for me to have some help, for me to get a little bit of relief and a little bit of hope. Because otherwise, it's got another plan. It'll reset. And I get a new plan. And without even knowing it, I'm back on this path. And here to report that, you know, that lifestyle that I was living is very much alive and well inside of the jail systems and the penitentiary. You know, I get loaded no matter what. Like, I don't care if it's, you know, I'm having to scrape fruit off my tray and, you know, save my sugars or what. Like, I couldn't stand me anymore. And here I am now in a place that I can't get out of again. And one of the only reasons I'm here today is because a man came to a jail. And he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he brought a meeting there. After processing, after the 23 hours and 50 minutes a day lockup, you know, after I got processed, you know, that first month, I'm still like have all this time over my head. A man came to a jail. We had a meeting. And I don't remember a single thing that we talked about in those meetings, but I remember he was there. I remember at the end of the meeting, he got in the elevator and he went down and left and went home to his family, his dog. And I went back to live with the four horsemen in a house about the size of a bathroom. And that was my world. I didn't have anybody to call. I was afraid, to say the least, but AA gave me a little bit of hope. And what can I do today? You know what? I knew that staying sober was a top priority. And I go back to that prayer answered in the back of the car. You know, like, I'd never had prayer answered that fast. Even to this day, I wish they would be answered a little faster sometimes. But this was like, question, answer. That's been my experience. I've tried a lot of other methods to get sober, but Alcoholics Anonymous seems to be the only thing that has allowed me to live happy, sober. And I knew that this was the path, but I still had to face the music and the, for reasons I can only explain as love, my parents refied the house or came up with some money to get me a nice lawyer so that I wouldn't spend, you know, pretty much the rest of my life in prison. And even with a nice lawyer, they were looking at a 7 to 10, for just the severity and the number of charges that I had was being convicted of. And then in an act, I mean, I can only give credit to a power greater than myself. My lawyer had a day in court and we were able to consolidate things and shift things and move things around and I ended up just getting 2 10 to 12 months back to back, so 20 to 24. Which compared to where we were coming from was a great plea that I signed. I don't know. At the same time, my dad was diagnosed with this terminal cancer. I'm still sitting in the jail. I didn't have any big books. I didn't have any of this other literature. But it was left between me and God. And like I told you, my relationship with this power was distant at best, because I had learned, you know, I grew up with a set of beliefs that God expected this from me, and I can't do X, Y, and Z. But it just so happened that X, Y, and Z were some of my favorite things to do after work and after school. So I felt like I was apart from God. There's no way I can ever win this, you know, this power's approval. So I just figured I was on his second string, and I'd still talk to him from time to time, but I didn't think he wanted anything to do with me. I was placed in a position to reconsider. I didn't have anybody else to talk to. So I just I just opened up the dialogue. I was like, God, you know, I'm scared. I don't know what I don't know what's going to happen. And I just began to pray. And through the process of doing my time in the penitentiary, I learned how that I could pray with my eyes open. It's a beautiful thing. I do it all the time. I can even pray. I've prayed while I'm talking right now. This channel that I believe is available to all of us is always there. And I was told that there's gonna come a time and a place where there's not gonna be anybody, there's no meeting to go to, there's no sponsor to call, there's not gonna be anything between you and your next drink than a power greater than yourself. It says this in our literature as well. You know, we'll be without mental defense. All of that pain and the misery that I have from 10 years of trying to control and enjoy my drinking, all of those rehabs, all of that stuff, all of the meetings I went to, all of it is great. But it doesn't have the power to keep me sober today. There'll come a time and place. And so it was pretty important, impressed upon me to start building this relationship. But I just, you know, I would just have conversations like we're talking right now. I moved forward and I knew that this AA thing, in order for it to work, there was something to do, you know, with these steps. You guys talked enough about them. And I had a sponsor before, well, I thought I did, I just had a telephone number and I'll... There's a difference. In case. But I knew I needed to throw myself in. If I was going to get the results that you guys received, I needed to do what you guys were doing. So as soon as I got my process in the state penitentiary, I got to go to a facility, a medium security, brown clothes, but it wasn't the max. It was available that I could go to school or I could go to work. And would you go? You meet with one of your caseworkers, and they give you these options. Would you like to go to school or work? And, you know, me, I have an old idea that money fixes things, so I need to go to work. And it's like, sorry, you can't go to work. You have to go to school. It's like, all right, well, what classes do you have? And they said, well, we have this baking class. I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds really good. I'm really hungry, you know. My appetite's got back. And she's like, well, sorry, that class is full. You can't work there. You can't go to school there. It's like, what the heck? You know, why'd you even tell me about it? And then ended up taking this horticulture class because I had some experience with closet tomatoes and working on a farm and stuff in the past. And so I was like, you know what? If I have to grow my own food, then so be it. You know, it'll be better than just eating the chow from. And I go and I had this incredible experience because what I realized is that, you know, we're planting seeds. We go into this greenhouse, we put some seeds down, and we put a little bit of water on the seeds. We make sure that it has light, we have, you know, good circulation. And then something miraculous happens that I don't have control over. This little seedling comes out of the seed. Little cute little green leaves pop out. And it's like, you know, you're just like, whoa, like, how'd that just happen? I didn't do it. I didn't reach in there and say, come on, that's what I was trying to do, you know, thinking that I know what's best for it, you know, and I might have yelled at a couple of them, hoping that they would pop, but, you know, it's like, that's exactly what happens here. That's exactly what happened with me. I was just a little seed. And then, so it's my responsibility now to keep the garden clean, to do the weeding, which I hate to do in real life and in the spiritual life. But it's some of the most important actions that I take is weeding the garden. Because it's not so much the stuff that I'm lacking, it's the stuff that I already have, these old ideas that are blocking me from the sunlight. And it was in that horticulture class that I met my first sponsor, and Terry was totally different socioeconomically. We were on different parts of the state. We just had, if you looked at us on paper, we were like, we weren't the same. But I was watching Terry, was listening to Terry in the meetings. He was sharing stuff out of the book, and he'd been sober for a while and was walking around, you know, with a quiet confidence about himself. And I asked him to sponsor me, and he said yes. We met out on the yard every Sunday. He would read the book, and I would listen, and, you know, that's the way it went for a while. And I was like, Terry, would you like me to read? And he's like, no. I was like, I can read. He's like, you need to listen. You would be much better to take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth for once. And, you know, it was that kind of direction that I'd so desperately needed. And I became maybe a little overly dependent on Terry. Because I was afraid. I was afraid to drink. I'm not going to lie. Like, my first few months of sobriety, like, I'm not only in prison, I'm probably the best, you know, the best looking guy on the cell block, and that wasn't a compliment or something I was proud of. But I was like, man, I need, you know, I always thought really highly of myself. But no, seriously, like, it was not a really a fun place to be. I wouldn't advise going. I'm so thankful for people like Tom I, who planted the seeds in North Carolina Department of Corrections, so that when I got there, Alcoholics Anonymous was there to meet me. And my first group there was self-supporting. We had a seventh tradition. You could go to the canteen and make a contribution. But I didn't have my own book. You know, I really wanted a book. I saw Terry had his, like, with underlines and, you know, things. And I'm like, man, that's cool. Like, I got things I need to underline. And but I didn't want to reach out for, I didn't want to reach out. And I feel my parents had already did way too much. I'd already burned every bridge there. I didn't want to give them false hope. So I said, Terry, what do? And he said, Matt, there's an address in the back of the book. The answers are in the big book, you know. It's So I wrote box 459. Didn't have much else to do, so I wrote him a letter. And I forgot I wrote the letter because it's a couple weeks have passed. And then I get called to the mailroom about, I don't know, 2 weeks later now it was. And I get a package from GSO, which was really, really awesome. Anytime you get mail, because you don't get bills when you're inside, so it's like it's a good thing when you get mail. Nowadays, not so much. But on top of that, there was a handwritten letter, which I saved. I've saved this letter, and it says, "Dear Matt, your recent letter has come to me as I'm currently serving on the corrections assignment here at the General Service Office. My name is Gail, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to have this opportunity to be in touch. It sounds as if you have paid a high price for your drinking, and I'm glad to know that you're turning to Alcoholics Anonymous for help." And at that very moment, my world got exponentially bigger. Because here I am, sitting inside a prison, this dusty old prison in North Carolina, and there's somebody outside of these walls, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's cared enough to write me a letter. And she sent me some literature. Be forever thankful for that. And I was just on fire and was reading my pamphlets all the time. And then one day I ran over to Terry's unit and I was like, "Hey, Terry," you know, I was like, "come out, check this out." And I was like, "look at concept 6, article 4. And he's like, "Matt, it's really important that you find a life outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. You find some activities to do other than..." And I was like, "what?" You see, my experience is that I'm here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous first and foremost because I'm an alcoholic and I can't stay stopped. And once I start, I don't know where it's going. I'm going to get locked up. But it's also important, like what's been shared this weekend, is that a much more important demonstration is in my other affairs. You guys, we come, we get to have this experience so that we can have a new life. At 23 years old, I was terrified. What am I going to do for the rest of my life? I had plans. I was planning on, you know, drinking champagne on yachts and stuff like that, you know, and I didn't even like champagne, but this was a plan that I had, you know, it just sounded good. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And Terry's like, "you know what? That plan sounds like it's a little bit outside of today. Do you think you could stay sober today?" Like, "yes, boss, I can do that." So by bringing it back to today, I found that there's other things I like to do. Now that the drink has been removed, so I took that, I was like, "yes, sir, okay, not bringing Terry any more of my revelations with these pamphlets, I'll keep them to myself." And I looked around and I started playing chess. It was just, you know, it was available. And so I started to do some other things outside of, you know. Now, don't get me wrong, don't hear what I didn't say. Like, if you got to hide out and anywhere, like, Alcoholics Anonymous is a safe place to hide out. It's been my experience, and I'm so thankful that as a result of coming here and throwing myself into this continually, I get to have a new life. And that life that I had is no more. It's not an improvised, like, Matt 2.0. Like, no, it is just a new. Like, we just totally trashed that life. It took time, and it took the application of these principles that I've learned through the steps. They're not revolutionary. I mean, they've been around for well longer than Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, just... But I needed them in a way, mainly from another alcoholic, to be able to digest and to apply them. The program of action is simple, but it is not easy. Because I have to look at me. I have to, you know, stop running. My sponsor tells the story about this Aboriginal tribe in New Zealand, and there was an anthropologist that went over some time back, and they were observing this tribe, and he would notice that, like, the tribe would be walking and going about, and all of a sudden they would stop, and they would stop and wait. A few minutes would pass, they would just stop, and then they would continue on and go about their way. And being naturally curious on what's happening, they asked, and this tribe said that in order for their soul to catch up with their bodies, they have to stop, because we can be so propelled by self that we need to stop from time to time and let our souls rejoin our body. And that is one of the tools that I've received from, or one of the benefits I've received from meditation, from using the tools, just being still. Like, I'm not perfect at meditating, because, and that's what kept me from actually trying it to begin with, is like, hey, if I'm not going to be like, you know, a monk level, you know, just whatever that is, you know, then I'm not going to do it. That's my MO. But little did I know that there's other activities, you know, that could be considered meditating, and not like sitting cross-legged, you know, shaving your head and, you know, hum type of meditation. That very well could be a practice, but that's not required of me to make my beginning. And so something started to change with Terry. Like, I remember in my first few months, like, starting to get into the book and starting, you know, I did my four-step with Terry, and I told him, I was like, Terry, there's going to be some things in here I'm not, in part of my life, that I'm not going to tell you. I'm not even going to write it down. I'm not stupid. Like, I'm not incredibly smart, obviously, based on my actions, but I'm not that stupid. Like, I'm willing to go to any lengths except for, like, you know, spending the rest of my life in this place. He's like, I understand. He's like, let's pray about it, and if you're willing to, at the next opportunity, to share those pieces that you haven't shared with me, that's all that's required. So that's what we did. We prayed about it. We got to step 8. I had a list of all the people who I had harmed. And then I was moved to another facility. By the time I got off the bus at the new facility, I already had a sponsor. Because we can get messages through the walls. And AA is everywhere. So they were definitely waiting on me. And my next sponsor, his name was Juan. And Juan said, you know what? Let's go back through the first 8. Just kind of touch on them, make sure that we're good. We got my 8-step list out, and he says, now, next to this name, you know, we did now, later, never, my first list, but now meant once I got out. Juan said, no, now means now. You need to get a piece of paper and a pen and start writing some letters. And I was like, man, this guy's no joke. I was like, let's do it. So he showed me exactly where in our literature what an amends is and what it is not. And I was able to write in very few words, this is what I did. This is, you know, I may not get over my drinking unless I take this step. I need to know what I can do right now to set it right. And so that was the course I took for those who were not able to come in and visit, which was most of my list. I started with my mom. She was at the top. And this is a woman who I did everything really possibly besides physically harm her, emotionally, spiritually. I mean, how can you even begin to set right the wrong? And so I told her, I was like, you know what? I wasn't as good of a son as I could have been. I need to know what I can do right now to set this right. Sent a letter, forgot I sent a letter. A couple weeks pass, I receive a response. And in her response, she says, Matt, the only thing that we want from you is for you to love yourself like we've loved you this whole time. And the floodgates opened, and Niagara Falls just struck with emotion. When I look back at that, I know that I'm sure you guys have heard God speak to you through other people. Maybe you've heard Him speak through you when words come out your mouth that you know aren't your own, and you're like, wow. I believe that God was speaking to me through my mom. and that's all God's ever wanted from me. See, here I am thinking that he's keeping score and that there's no way I'm going to be able to be on his A team. Because I've waved on. Like, I like the riding the bench and the stuff that they do on the bench more than, you know, what it takes to be a saint. But today, that's not my understanding of God. God loved me in the middle of it. The difference is that, you know what, when I do poorly these days, I don't like me as much. God loves me regardless. That is God. So my mom gave me this great letter. I would have much rather her like said, "You owe me $5,000 and we'll call it even," you know, because two. But I took that and I still do. And my sponsor at the time said that, "Matt, you need to be available and to go see her, you know, once a week when you get out. And try to make time for her." And it's 13 years later, I can say that I've still been able to do that. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. About a week later, I go out onto the yard. Important piece. While I was at this facility working with Juan, I had crossed paths with a priest who ended up hearing the rest of my fourth step and discussing that part of my past that I didn't want to share with another inmate. And I talked with him today. We had a chance to catch up a little bit today. I'm still close with him and I love him dearly as well. If I'm going to tell you my life secrets, I know where you are at all times. I want to make sure you don't go. Just a beautiful man as well. And about, you know, like I said, a week after that, or sometime after, I walk out onto the yard and all of a sudden I don't see anybody else out there. And I kind of got scared a bit because that mean the yard is closed and that could mean I'm going to get shot. So it was a little bit of a panic at first, but then I continued to look out and I didn't see any of the fences and the guard towers were gone and I'm just standing there at the top of this little knoll and I felt this sunlight come down through me from the top of my head down through my feet and I felt like a free man standing inside of a medium security prison. And I don't know how long I stood there, but it was just long enough to know that I'm not the same man that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. That this something is changing. I didn't know what it was, but I could start to feel a transformation of some sort. And I go on, and I realize too now, looking back, that I was doing time well before I went to prison. And most of us, you know, the bondage of self keeps us in prisons in the free world, in my experience, can be worse than the ones when you're on lockup. Neither are fun. I think they could be worse because my mom said she slept better when I was in prison than when I was out in the free world. So maybe that prison is worse. I don't know. But I continued through this process and bounced, you know, kept a sponsor. I kept working. I had the opportunity to work with others. Had the opportunity to be of service, you know, in the group. And my last prison I was at was in Lincolnton, and it was a minimum security prison. And a guy came, his name was Bob, and he said he came to prison so he doesn't come to prison. And I'm like, that's a really interesting concept. So tell me more. And we had the opportunity to work the steps together. And Bob is also a dear friend today. He sponsored me when I got released. And my dad, like I said, was diagnosed with this rare cancer, and I had the opportunity to make amends when he was in prison, and he said that he would be there to pick me up when it was time to come home. And by the grace of God and against doctor's orders, he drove. They had moved to Tennessee since I'd been locked up, and he drove to North Carolina to pick me up as promised. And I was able to spend the rest of his life, which would have been 4 months, with him. I need to go to Tennessee. I don't know anybody in Tennessee besides my mom and my dad, but thankfully there's Alcoholics Anonymous in Tennessee. And I got connected with a guy as soon as I landed, just like in prison, like they were waiting for me. And he brought me in with open arms. He welcomed me into Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad's dying, but I knew, and Bob was really big on service. Like, you had to get involved in service. You had to get a home group. You had to, you know, suggestions, like the parachute. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. So I get involved, and I'm like, how do you get involved in service? He's like, find some old-timer at your meeting and ask him. So I go up to Detroit Dave after the meeting. I said, hey, Detroit, I'd like to get involved in service. And he looks at the guy next to him, and he's like, he wants to get involved in service. Starts laughing at me. I was like, Dave, I don't know what's so funny here, man. I'm like, I need to get involved. He's like, come to the business meeting on Thursday. We'll get you hooked up. And I left that business meeting a GSR. Which is a group service representative for those that don't know. And it was propelled me right into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of a sudden now I go to my first assembly and I meet people from Knoxville to Memphis and everywhere in between, and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the men and women who have recovered all support me now in this journey, and now I have friends everywhere. My dad passed shortly thereafter. I had the opportunity, though, before he did, to sit on the couch with him and hand him a first-year medallion, because I knew he wasn't going to make four, or he wasn't going to make my 2-year. And the look in his eyes when I gave him that 1-year medallion was priceless. And he said, you know, I'm so proud of you. And he never got to meet any of you, I'm pretty sure, but I'll tell you what, he loves each and every one of you because you gave him his son back. And those last 18, 20 months that we were able to spend together were some of the best years, best time that we had since I was a kid. And when he passed, you know what, I was okay. We were whole. There was nothing left unsaid. I got to be by his side and tell him I loved him and that it's okay that I'm going to be there and take care of my mom and my sister, and sure enough, when he passed, I was there. That's not the same man that came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to handle pain, and I have been able to continue to be there for my mom and sister, and my sister had asked me a year after to walk her down the aisle. I hadn't been to too many weddings, so I didn't even know like what the protocol was there, but it was an incredible honor. And through the process of placing Alcoholics Anonymous first, I was able to have this incredible life built up around it. I was able to go to school, 2 years, turned into a 4-year degree, turned into an opportunity to get my master's in France, and I don't even speak French. But they offered the opportunity, and I said, well, you know, it sounds great. But as soon as my mind has said, as soon as they figure out who I am and my record, they're not going to let me out of the country. Or they're going to, like, not let me back in when I try to come back in, one or the other. But thankfully, you know, I had encouragement from sponsor and home group members. They're like, Matt, just do the footwork. Let God take care of that. And then Tom said, you know, let, you know, the guards have the keys, but God opens and closes the gates. And that's been my experience with the borders too, because within 3 months of getting an opportunity to go and travel abroad, I was on a big plane crossing a big lake, you know, with a passport and a student visa, and I was like 30, I think, at the time. But I traveled and lived in France for a year or two. And here I am, you know, I'm walking the cobblestone streets of Paris on my way to my home group. The American Cathedral beginners meeting. And I'm like, how does a man go from there, from the 8x10 to the cobblestone streets? And it's only by the grace of God and only through these steps that I was able to have that awakening and have that transformation that's required. And people love to drink over there. You tell them you don't drink, and they're like, but it's just wine. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, like, I have class on Monday, and it's like, it's Thursday. And it's like, you know what, I'll end up in a hash bar in Morocco or something like that, for God's sake. Like, I don't I don't even want to know where this, you know. But it's cool because I've learned through, you know, through growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous that there are people out there who just don't drink. Believe it or not. Like, I don't need to tell people, like, you know, my experience, strength, and hope whenever they ask me if I want to drink. I thought I used to. And when I started to date, too, like, I was like, yeah, let me tell you, I just got out of prison. They're like, nah. Like, don't tell my dad that, you know, like, and, but I've been able to, like, do all types of crazy, and I am a wacko. Like, I'm not all there, you know, I'm okay with it today. And like my sponsor says, people don't get locked up into mental institutions for being crazy. They get locked up for acting crazy. If you don't tell them, they don't know. Just in case anybody's out there, you know. But I'm having a joy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead of, you know, rearranging my life to suit my drinking, I place Alcoholics Anonymous in the middle of my life. And then all types of things have started to happen. The relationships that I have today are just so beautiful. The men that I sponsor, like I said, I have a great relationship with my mom and my sister. And I even got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober. It's crazy. You can do all types of things. She's not one of us, but she's definitely an angel. And I don't know how I just feel like one of the luckiest guys in the world sometimes. And I know I'm not different. That's what's so cool is that, like, I've seen it work in other people. And I know other people could stand up here and have stood up here and shared the love that I hope I've shared in just the same. And I do want to end with this one reading on the page of 100. It says, this is talking about our 12th step. And it says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Thank you so much. God bless you all.